types became extinct, and the other continued to live, continued to go on, and continued to pass through continuing modifications of structure, until gradually out of this prehistoric distribution there took place the thing which Darwin describes for us, namely this ascent, in which out of the mammal, out of the link, perhaps out of the anthropoidal juncture between the divisions of mammals, man came, different from the other. Yet man was never the horse, never the brontosaurus in the true sense of the word, although his growth had to be through these forms. He was always potentially himself, because he contained within himself the capacity for a kind of growth that survived the process of being born into a lower kingdom, that just refused to be born and lost there. It kept on going until finally it reached its humanity, and then it was born. Now, when this differentiation took place, I don't presume that we would have been particularly excited over the early product. In other words, perhaps if we had been able to take a good look at the world at that time and had seen our own progenitor and compared that progenitor with some finely constructed member of the animal kingdom, we would say that man represented a distinct loss of ground. In other words, he did not necessarily at that time have even the semi-prepossessing attributes of Gabriel Mack's painting of the missing link. He left much to be desired from a cosmetic standpoint. He was probably less efficient, less effective than the animal. He probably had a very difficult early struggle, because gradually this change in his development and growth, his growth being slower, the need for protecting him during infancy was greater than that of any other animal. Gradually changes had to take place, and the survival of man against the primary world around him was possible only because he possessed the rudiment of a superior faculty of cognition. He possessed something, mind, even though it was only in rudiment, which still gave him just the edge necessary for survival. If he hadn't possessed that, he probably would not have survived. But in the Lemurian world, which was distributed over this vast area, we see the gradual development of man. We see the division taking place. And finally, man and the animal, previously not distinguishable, thrown into contrast with each other. And out of that, the inevitable victory of the man over the animal. The gradual rise of the first primitive social state, in comparison to which that the Digger Indian or anything that we know today would be comparatively highly elevated. Every once in a while we hear of someone who has had long conversation with some Lemurian priest or something on the Ouija board. It's all right, but we have very little reason to assume that the Lemurian priest would know anything that could possibly be of interest to us. Because actually the Lemurian priesthood was lower than any form of human life we have on earth today. Yet in its own time, it was the highest life then on the planet, because all the other life belonged to a different order. And man began to make that little stone axe. He began to learn how to throw the rock. He learned how to find the cave and hide. He learned by degrees to create the bone fishhook, and ultimately he discovered fire. And when he discovered fire, he became master of the world. So, in these days, man and the animal looked very much alike. They ate the same food. They lived in the same range. They struggled for the same values. And according to the ancient traditions, there were many strange commixtures. In those days, the rudimentary patterns of man and animal interbred, as there was no clear vision, no clear distinction between them. And out of that interbreeding came monsters. And out of these monsters, as Sanchoniathon tells us, came strange creatures that ultimately perished away, because wherever a monster of this kind was born, like the hybrid, it was sterile. And therefore, orders of life began to disappear. And we have a very important study back in there, but it's going to take a long time to unravel it. Because still, we are dealing with situations in which your fossil remain is of very little value. Your fossil remain cannot give you, in the early Lemurian period, very much that could have survived. In the later Lemurian period, perhaps those first fragments that we now honor so great, such as the Pithecanthropus erectus and the Piltdown man and the Neanderthal man, and these bone fragments that are our only link, but which do tell us that man has been here as a human being, potential at least, for millions of years. In the Lemurian period also, something else happened that was of tremendous importance, and that is the transition gradually in the formation of the bisexual creature from the androgen. Nearly all primitive forms of life, as we explore them, and even today, rudimentary forms of life in water particularly, are androgynous. And your sexually polarized entity or being, when it arose, began immediately to contribute two factors. The first factor being the need for two creatures to reproduce their kind, and the opposite polarity being the release of one pole of creative energy for the stimulation of the mental psychic organism. Thus, by breaking the ring of the gods, by stealing this ring away, man became a thinker. By breaking the circuit of generation within himself, he became dependent upon another creature to complete generation, but he also became capable of thought. But he also, whether he realized it or not, caused another circuit. This, the primary psychic mental circuit, which also requires polarization for creation. This we have not entirely come to understand up to the present time. So in the older tradition, it was during the Lemurian era, or great epoch of time, that man as we know him emerged into the progenitor type with which we are more or less familiar today. We learn also that in the struggle for this growth, that man gradually came into possession of his sensory powers. Obviously, the primary world had very little need of sensational function as we know it. We are told, for instance, that the sense of feeling, which is the most generally diffused of our senses, was the earliest, and the sense of sight the last to be added. The sense of sight is an exceedingly perishable one, and is already, generally speaking, beginning to fail. It is the sense of sight, psychologically, which seems to be strangely involved in the gradual rise of our great materialistic culture. The eye has destroyed man's internal vision. And actually, the eye is an externalization of that internal vision. And gradually, man, through the development of the sense of sight, has become hopelessly involved in the illusion of matter. This was his last faculty, and perhaps the one which he will first lose. The other faculties of sensory perception were compensated for by the activity of the pineal gland. And in the Hyperborean period particularly, this vegetable-like antenna, very much like the antenna of the insect, was available as a general organ of orientation. Man originally developed organs of sensitivity, but he still depended largely upon internal vision. And it was not until his orientation in the Lemurian era that the organ of internal vision was finally closed, and man was forced to go forth to earn his bread by the sweat of his brow. He was launched into the material world, and what had previously been his inner life, or his contact with the causal sphere behind, retired gradually into the condition of folklore. This is also repeated in the small child, who possesses certain psychic faculties until it reaches from 5 to 7 years of age, when these faculties have a tendency to disappear. They disappear particularly as the development of the skull closes the sensitive area at the crown of the head, which lies directly over the pineal gland or the ancient third eye. Now we have this Lemurian area, this vast distribution of land, producing gradually a primitive people. This primitive people began to cultivate certain values and virtues, but we begin to realize another problem. Here is a world gradually coming into existence, a great experiment in the retort of nature. A world in which man was already old, but not as man. Because he was old as the protoplasm, he was old as the plant, he was old perhaps as a geological creature, back in the early days of prismatic crystal forms. But he was there a long time. But he was also being moved. And the ancients were of the opinion that during this long cradle land time of man, that it was necessary for him to have been under certain guidance, under certain leadership or direction. And this was particularly true when finally man made this strange jump in the dark, which is said to have occurred at the time, approximately the middle of the Lemurian epoch. At that time, the being which was awake and alive on the magnetic planes behind the physical earth, which had previously only experienced its body as a dream, suddenly fulfilled the Narcissus myth, suddenly enamored of its new form, fell into it and was drowned in matter, and was no longer able to escape back. It was descending like the child into material birth. Prior to quickening particularly, the being is in a condition to work upon its body. But once this quickening occurs, the being is locked in the body in a state of total unconsciousness. And from there it must gradually escape, fighting its way first to birth, then to growth, then to maturity. It must force its way through this wall of matter. Now, in the ancient times, it was believed when this great balance was achieved in the Lemurian epoch, and the humanity that we know, the true humanity, first made its complete step into a primordial human form, was locked therein and went to sleep in this thing which preceded the Cro-Magnon, preceded the Piltdown man. This thing that was much like an animal, perhaps could not be told from one. And this human being was locked in that, this human potential. Then, according to the ancient writings, came the period in which the gods, or the celestial teachers, the leaders, those who were the keepers of mankind, began to appear as the shepherds, as the keepers of the flocks. And we had the setting up of the great empire of the gods and the establishment of priestly orders or of esoteric hierarchies. the purposes of these being to guide humanity through the long darkness of embryonic development and infancy. These were therefore the fathers, the Petras, the great ancestral ones, who are said to have come from the moon and from other distant places and became the keepers of men. For just as the human being must be guided into birth and through the darkness of total infancy by its parents, so the whole race of human creatures had to be guided into birth and through infancy and through early adolescence by the establishment of the great orders of rulership. These orders of rulership were originally the priest-king orders. They became the basis not only of spiritual government but of temporal government. But most of all, they were the parents. They were the ones who knew, the old ones, the sages, who became the prophets, the teachers, the messiahs, the guardians of this world half-born, which could not yet lead its own way into light. So when man became man, then became the need for the setting up of the great protective instrumentation, because man possessed greater power than any other creature that had been fashioned. Therefore, the danger of man misusing this power, of destroying himself with it, had constantly to be faced. And higher orders of life represented in the ancient writings, the gods of the Puranas and the Vedas, these deities moved in as the keepers, as the custodians, the shepherds, the psychopompous of souls, and became now in our legendary the gods who walked with men in the beginning of things, the angels who were in the Garden of Eden, who taught Adam and Eve, all these mysterious references to the great teachers of the prehistoric era, not the ones we know in more modern times, but the ancient ones who are now myths almost, the great Manus of the first cycles, these strange dim figures of the god mortals, and these great form of the invisible government of the planet that slowly assumed proportion and took over the management in the darkness when men could not govern themselves. So the Lemurian epic became important for this rocking of the cradle that was to finally produce the next great order of things. Now the Lemurian era, according to what record we have of it, was finally broken up, disrupted, shattered by tremendous earth convulsions. It was in that time that the primitive world was shaken to pieces. Perhaps those of you who saw musical film that Mr. Disney did, in which Tarkovsky directed the music, in which the prehistoric world and its monsters were represented in animation, will realize something of this idea that there was in that time a great shaking and shuddering of the earth. Or as the old records of the East used to say, the great mother turned, lay upon one side, and then upon the other, and in the course of turning, shook worlds from her back. And this is the thought that is concealed in the idea. And out of this tremendous change and shifting of things emerged the fourth great distribution, which we call the Atlantic Empire, or Atlantis, the Poseidonian world. Now, most people, the moment you mention Atlantis, get an idea of an island out in the Atlantic Ocean. That's it. But that is only in the terms of geology or the geography or geophysics of our problem. That island, the island of Poseidonis, was the last stronghold of the ancient world. It was not the great Atlantis. It was the remnant. It was the last part of the great empire to be shaken into oblivion. Atlantis was actually a diffusion, like all of the other continents. And part of Southern California was above water in Atlantis during the Atlantean period. Part of Russia, most of India, practically all of Mongolia was above water. Area after area that we associate with existing present areas were above the level of the ocean, and there was an enormous area of land. In fact, there was a larger land area than there is now, but not a land area that contained one square inch that was not in the first continent, because all this is taking place within the boundaries of that first great psychological land statement, that land archetype. And in the Atlantic area then, a new kind of people began to develop. The Lemurian progenitor had reached a certain degree of growth. We will explain this problem of the emanation of racial groups later. All we want to do is to move the general theme as much as we can. The Atlantic distribution did not immediately center in what we call the Atlantic Ocean area. The Atlantic distribution seems to have centered originally in many of those parts of Asia, particularly in the area we call China. And here, and in many other parts of the world, sporadic developments of peoples began to be marked. These peoples grew more rapidly, individualized more quickly. And of course, what is important about them, they brought with them, under the guidance of these teachers that we have mentioned, the adept fathers, the great ones, they brought a new level of organization, and the Atlantean had already begun his rise as an intellectual being. The Lemurian man was still sort of fighting for survival with nature. He was in the process of orientation. The Lemurian man was perhaps equivalent to the small child, whereas the Atlantean was reaching out toward that glorious age of human adolescence. He was reaching out toward growth, expansion, power, and everything of that nature. And he attained it. And he moved from one part of the world to another. He drifted into certain commixture with the previous Lemurian factors. He continued to migrate considerably from one part of his world to another, until finally, at the height of his control of the planet, he was extended practically over the entire earth. He was divided into many groups, into many orders. He was a diffusion of peoples, just as we are a diffusion now, extending with many sub-races and divisions all over the planet. But just as certain nations, certain empires, certain areas seem to rise with us, we might say, for example, that the island of Posidonis could correspond with North America in relation to the rest of the diffusion of our present world order, or the great island continent of Australia, or one of these enormous land areas. And by degrees, the Atlantean Empire, the great Atlantic distribution, was eroded away. It did not disappear in the way, same way that the Lemurian world disappeared, by great shudderings and shakings. It seems to have been chewed away around its circumference over great periods of time. Some feel that this chewing process was due to the rotation of the earth and the banking up against stratifications which were to be mountains. Mountains probably already existed, but perhaps due to the rotation of the earth, the Atlantic Empire began to erode away, began to fall off, break off here, break off there, until according to the description left by Solon, at about 12,000 years B.C., nothing remained but the island of Posidonis. This area which had become the final island empire of Atlantis. Now that does not mean that no other Atlantic empire existed, that all the rest had disappeared. But it means the cultural diffusion, the psychological body of Atlantis, had disappeared gradually, broken away. Now, when a nation breaks away, when a country breaks away today, what does this mean? It doesn't mean that it just simply falls off and vanishes. The usual cause for the breaking up or breaking away of patterns is the infusion of a new culture from somewhere. Something begins eating on it. And about a million years ago, in the upper highlands of the Trans-Himabat, the Aya, or the people of Or, or the chosen ones, began to migrate down the great Indo-Gangetic plain from the north and began to move into the suburbs of the Atlantic Empire. These people found numerous values and relationships as they went along. Little by little, they eroded away the Atlantean psychology wherever they conquered it, wherever they contacted it, because they were newer, because they represented a progressive step in the individualization of peoples. And so by degrees, the rise of another tide of nations, another tide of races, little by little the Atlantean empire was constricted. Little by little, its outskirts, like a great temporal empire today, were cut off by the freeing of peoples, by the emancipation of nations, also by natural cataclysms that separated, until little by little nothing remained except the one great nuclear center of Atlantis, which was the last stronghold of a dying race. Everywhere else, the Atlantean had either accepted mixture with other peoples or had been exterminated or had simply slipped into the incredible crucible of change and was no longer clearly demarked anymore. They weren't all dead, but they had ceased to have archetypal entity. They had been absorbed into other archetypal patterns. But the Posidonians remained to the end. And it was their island which, according to the ancient record, sank in a single night, carrying 60 million souls to death. This was the end of the power of Atlantis. But let us also remember that the Atlantic Empire never could actually die, any more than the Lemurian could die, any more than the Hyperborean or the Polarian could die, because every one of these diffusions still exists right inside of ourselves. We cannot escape it. We are stratified with one layer of culture upon another inside of our own natures. All of these continents that seem to have been submerged into us. They have also been submerged into the great psychic field of the planet. They all live. And because, if we can borrow a little phrase again from Newton, if we see further than these others, it's because we're standing on them. They're all still here. Without Atlantis, our world couldn't have existed. So behind and within every Aeon movement is an Atlantic root. And somewhere that Atlantic root has its taproot going down into the Lemurian soil. Because man has no break in his growth at all. But every condition that exists in a certain age is submerged in succeeding ages as a new surface is constantly added, pressing the other back, but forming out of this tremendous pressed back content the whole great psychic field of the internal of the individual. So all these things continue to exist and to function and to have their bearing. And every individual of our race has a submerged Atlantis inside of himself, with all the other trimmings that go with it. Now, this loss of the Atlantic world ended the great cycle of material growth of man. For it was in Atlantis, in the fourth great field cycle, that actually humanity hit bottom. Now, we may not like to think that that was possible. We prefer to think we're hitting lower than they ever succeeded in hitting. But that is not factually true. Man is already in the evolutionary arc. He has already completed the involutionary period, where in the Atlantic era, he reached the greatest degree of the densification of his own organism and the greatest consolidation of focalizing of energies upon the material vehicle. He is already beginning the great program of release. This led one of the ancient authors to point out that Atlantis produced many great geniuses on a scientific level, but it never produced a philosopher, because the reflective mind had not been born. The reflective mind came with the great rise of the Aryas. And this migration of peoples is also very interesting and carries with it many points that we should remember. Now, we wonder, for instance, how humanity, one people, one type of being, can manage to get itself into such a confused social state. It would not seem possible that humanity could be in such trouble. After all, why don't we know we're all brothers? Why don't we start with that premise? That would be all right if it wasn't for Kepler's observation of the significance of the time equation. Time is what has made enemies of us all in the course of history. For time has played a peculiar trick on everything that lives and on everything that generates itself. We know, for example, that from the hinterland of every racial root, races pour out in waves. They do not all flow at once. In every group of people, there are a few pioneers that start out. When we decided to conquer the West, everybody in the East didn't move West. The ones that moved West were the adventurers, and also, to a certain degree, the malcontents of various kinds. Some wanted for crimes, decided open country was the best. Some were tired of the limitations and restrictions of the old way of things. They were looking for adventure, for fortune and fame. So a certain level peeled off of our Eastern life and went West. Now, after 25 years, a West was built that was different from what had occurred in the beginning. And a West that needed shops and merchants and stores began to develop. Whereupon another group peeled off from the East and moved West to meet the first group. When the two groups met, they both came from the same place, but 25 years later they met as strangers. Each had now had a completely different group of experiences. The man who had gone first and opened the way kind of resented the fellow that came along and profited by it and hadn't done anything himself. And the man from the East coming out at that time was a little leery of the chap with a gun on each hip. That was something he'd never seen before. Now imagine that instead of a little simple problem like this, that we'll take the motherland of a race, and we'll say that at a certain date, date one, out of this nuclear center, a surplus group, either that can no longer be fed or can no longer be maintained in an area that is without great advantages, which was the case in this particular instance, a superfluous group, maybe 500 people, 500 families perhaps, maybe 5,000, who knows. But anyway, this group moved out, and in this particular case, moved south, tumbling down over these great mountains, found very pleasant, fertile plain with good land, good material, perhaps a few aboriginal peoples from earlier life race cycles. And of course, immediately we see what happened in the case of the Indic, where we find the development of the Vedic literature text, which was full of early admonitions to prevent these new people from becoming anthropologically involved in the settlement of earlier races into whose area they moved, and therefore created the uncast, the outcast, and all this type of thing. But in any event, here these people come and they settle. The climate is different, the land is different. 10,000 years pass. By this time, most of the culture is different. Even the religion is now a religion of tradition, constantly modified by new local circumstances. Perhaps the old religion was one of great privation. The individual had to be very strong in order to sacrifice himself for the common good. But in this new lush area where these people had settled, there was no sacrifice. So religion changed, culture changed, art changed. These people became very much adjusted group. Even the color of the skin changed because the climate was different. Clothing changed. The memory of the ancients was all that was left. And that memory, passing from generation to generation, was deformed by lack of formal perpetuation, no written record in those days, until even the legends didn't fit together anymore. But everyone was satisfied with the whole thing. And then, you see, after this 10,000 years, up in the hinterland of the mother root, another migration starts out. Now, these two migrations, if they ever meet, are going to meet as total strangers. They're going to have nothing in common. If the first migration had carefully preserved the records of the motherland, they would still be no better off, because 10,000 years of change had occurred in the motherland also. And that wasn't the same anymore. Those who came forth in the second migration could have been given a perfect description of those who had preceded them 10,000 years. They would never recognize them because the descendants did not look the same. So these two charming groups of people, both from the same origin, if they actually got a little unhappy and wanted each other's land or something of that nature, would simply go to war, having no sense of common origin. Or, as more likely in the early days, there was plenty of land, so they went somewhere else and started another community. Now, these two communities could never be alike. Because by the time the second community got 10,000 years of experience, the first community had 20. In the meantime, in the kind of a sort of a cosmic game of billiards or something of that nature, a third migration came down and impacted the other two. And so it goes. Periodic migrations over a period of a million years, moving downward relentlessly, finally reaching so much congestion in the nearer areas that it was necessary to push further to get this new land, to go on. And these migrations from Central Asia finally got as far as the British Isles, trying to find a place that had not already been taken by somebody else. They also found the remnants of the Atlanteans functioning. They found a few remnants of the Lemurian, and they probably extinguished a few early animal types that had survived from the Hyperborean period. All they had a few of the real early Lemurian mammals, such as the whale, to concern themselves with. So here was a polyglot, all starting from a unity, with the sense of unity completely lost. And by degrees, we find this great Aryan diffusion of worlds, which was again a great distribution. This Aryan diffusion is now nearly a million years old. We know that whether we recognize it or not, it is changing. 400 miles of the coast of Peru fell into the sea some years ago. Nobody noticed it, except a few Peruvians. Somewhere else, something else is coming up from below. We don't notice these things. We are told that our sea coast is changing 5 inches every 100 years. Well, no one is going to subdivide that for a long time. But what about a million years from now? ultimately, these lines will not be the same as they are today. There will be other distributions of land. There will be other formations of territorial boundaries. And according to the old tradition, there will be the sixth great land distribution will appear. And this sixth land distribution will be the sixth great continental structure. And in that sixth cultural field, a new race will be born. A new race in which a new type of being, human in appearance, but with a new psychology of life, will carry on the next dimension of the great social program which has to do with the development of mankind. The next social program must, of course, be concerned by archetypal extension with a problem. So the second or the next great continental distribution will be devoted to a people challenged with one problem, and a problem which ultimately they will probably solve, and that is the problem of death. That is the problem that has to be solved. That problem must be solved because it has already been solved, but nobody knows it. It has already been solved because the first man who lived upon earth is still alive. He never died. We are that man. But how are we going to discover the law of controlling this fact? This tremendous biological descent of life is the living of the first being. But the rescuing of this situation, we must know that the secret that the first man knew, the last man must rediscover. For the first shall be last. And this being must again be restated. So in the sixth great organic structural diffusion, there will be moved into the theater of life a race which must solve the great problem that relates to death. And one of the problems, of course, that relates to death is war. So war has got to be solved. But it will not be solved by this race. It must be solved by the next race. Now the question is, does the next race exist yet? For that, I think we should have to wait for our continued discussion, and I think that'll probably get a good many folks here to find out about that. But now to go on to another subject, which is not related to this phase of it, but to the that the sixth continental distribution, this is continents that we're primarily concerned with, the sixth continental distribution apparently will center in the great area which we now call the Trans-Pacific Basin, extending from the western part of the United States to Asia. And this great western area, this area may or may not be a solid continent at that time. It could be that there won't be much more land than there is now. There could be some more. But there could be a great rim of culture surrounding this area. And this culture could be bridged by intangibles of air, such as the aeroplane, which is killing distances. So your next racial or continental distribution is free of the distance equation almost totally. What is this leading us to? It is leading us to what we psychologically or politically like to think of as one world. But what is this one world? This one world is the restoration of the first world, and that is your seventh distribution. In the seventh distribution, everything that was locked archetypally in the first must have reached maturity, must have released itself, because in this seventh cycle of each of these great arcs, there has to be the Sabbath or the great day of rest. This is the fulfillment. This is, so to say, the full awaking, and is usually represented in symbolism by a kind of golden age. This is the completion of the karma of the thing, that cycle in which all things that have been earned come to pass. But in the larger way of thinking, it is the total release of the potential of the first continent. Now, when the seven continents are complete, the earth is born. Because all of this growth of the planet takes place within the embryonic field of the magnetic sphere. The magnetic sphere actually incarnates through the psychochemical fields of these so-called continents and the creatures that are engendered in them. And therefore, the complete incarnation of the magnetic field is accomplished only with the seventh continent. Then the planet comes of age. Then the planet reaches the fulfillment of its own peculiar destiny. And having blazed forth its own seven potentials, and having perfected them, the continents become the embryonic principles of planets, and the total planet becomes a sun. So the seven continental distributions become the seven planets of a new system. Now, if the original archetype is seven, this has to happen. If the original archetype was nine, then there would be nine cycles, nine of everything, and nine planets. But in our system, it is seven. Therefore, the continents finally become the keys to the evolving of these different levels, which are going to become planets. Each of the six preceding is contained in the seventh. And the seventh and its complete pattern, being a totally expressed potential. There is a very interesting alchemical reference to this particular situation, in which it is shown how the metals, which are of course the symbols of your psycho-alchemical mystery, also of course of your races, your continents, every septenary that exists in nature, where these coming together form themselves into a kind of star, and out of the 6 days of creation and the day of rest comes the great six-pointed star of the shield of David with the dot in the center of the Kabbalah. And here we have the six manifestations surrounding the central core. Now if you put the seven, the six, and the dot all within a circle, you immediately create the symbolic archetype of a new solar system. Because the circle now becomes the body of the sun, within which, again, this whole differentiation must take place. And immediately your continents become the new continents of a solar system. Because in a solar system, each planet is a continent. And each of the planets, in turn, has its own way of development. And these planets are fulfilled in the sun. And in the seventh day, or the great rest, all of the planetary powers are fulfilled in the sun itself. And when the sun states its own total septenary with the planets, then the sun and the planets burst into a cosmic system. And each of the planets becomes a solar sun. Again, the number determined by the archetypal pattern at the root of the grouping. And there are many universal systems, and there are many cosmic chains, each according to different basic mathematical patterns. But in our concept, therefore, we see the growth of the planet producing seven fields that appear physically as chemical, but which are actually psychological. For these continents, although they come forward as physical symbols, are actually representative of magnetic areas and zones within the psychic organism of the planet itself. Now, the planet is a crystal, an earth, a planet, is a crystal. This crystal is composed of an infinite number of minute parts united mysteriously and mathematically and capable of being released only by shock or by fission, in which the broken parts become miniatures of the whole all the way down through, just as in the breaking of crystals. Now, what we call a fault or an earthquake fault is one of the lines of cleavage of a crystal, the lines of, along which it will break. These faults and all that have to do with them are again part of the psychological anatomy of a planet. And a planet has organ, structure, and body just exactly like any other living thing. The great mystery systems of the ancients were diffused around the planet in such a way that the seven vital magnetic cores of the planet were each covered by one of the temples. And these were the seven sacred orifices of the earth, where the magnetic fields had their great centers. And each one of your racial groups or your continents flows from one of these magnetic fields, completing itself, exhausts itself in giving birth to the next, and so on until the complete septenary is concluded. And having completed itself, these fields, these magnetic fields behind the planetary continents, these are the magnetic zones, these whirling zones that then become the vortices of new planets, and of course the physical materials are gathered around them. So that this infinite process of growing goes on and on and on, fulfilling the evolution of this great sevenfold pattern. And I think this sevenfold pattern would naturally lead then to a more detailed discussion of the races, which will be our subject for next week. And there are many things about the races that will be very, very interesting to us, and a number of popular bubbles, I'm afraid, are going to be broken in one way or another. But I think we'll do it as pleasantly as possible. I'd like to call attention to the fact that we have...